Coming up on Path to Zero.
You know, batteries aren't going to work for long-range aviation. There's really a role for liquid fuels for long-range trucking. You can't have a 40-ton truck with 39 tons of battery.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, and welcome to Path to Zero. You know, it's fair to say that there's an urgent search underway for solutions to address carbon-related climate change. We see news about hydrogen, small modular nuclear, ammonia, batteries, solar, wind, and a dozen ideas in between, all trying to be zero carbon answers. In addition, air pollution continues to be a big problem in many of our cities. That's why there's an increasing awareness of the need for low emissions fuels. In today's episode, I'm visiting with a company that is addressing both these fronts. Today, liquid fuels innovator World Energy is making a huge investment in a new biofuel and hydrogen production facility in Southern California. The company acquired the former Paramount Petroleum facility in 2018 to jumpstart its progress in this space. Instead of refining petroleum and asphalt, World Energy is transforming the facility to produce clean, renewable biofuels. Gary Grimes, World Energy's Director of Sustainability and Technology, leads the initiative, and I'm really excited to have him with us today to talk about the progress the company is making and to share his thoughts about the big picture regarding our journey towards a low-carbon future. It's great to talk to you, Gary, and welcome to Path to Zero.
Thank you. Thank you, Tucker. It's great to be here. I think the last time we had an event together has been a while back in the middle of COVID. But it's great to see you again.
And I feel like a lot has happened in the world of renewable fuels. So we're really looking forward to catching up. You know, we have talked about your company, World Energy, quite a bit. It's really a name we like to talk about as a model of success for the future. But for people who aren't familiar with World Energy, give us just a brief overview of the company, please.
Sure. It's a privately held company. Our headquarters is in Boston, Massachusetts, and relatively small company. We have, well, I guess it depends on the industries you're looking at. In the renewable diesel and in biodiesel, and this company got started in biodiesel about 25 years ago by Gene Gabalis, his CEO today, and he's kept this company running through the ups and downs of that industry. And today our focus is no longer the biodiesel, although we still have six facilities that are fully biodiesel manufacturing facilities. And we do have this renewable diesel plant out in Southern California where I work. And that plant makes renewable diesel, which is different and distinct chemically than biodiesel. We have a different process. We actually do a refining process inside a refinery. This plant had a history as a petroleum refinery, and it was the first conversion from a petroleum refinery to renewable fuels refinery. We did a piece of it a few years ago. We started in 2012. It's been a decade since we've run petroleum through this plant, and we've converted it over now partially to this renewable process with renewable feedstocks. And we're planning, we call that plant A. And we're moving on now to plant B. And we just got our permits earlier this year for plant B. In California, you know, that's a fairly long process. And the next couple of years, we'll be through construction while we're running on plant. And that's where we're at with that site there in Southern California. We were looking at other sites in the country, effectively, where we might also be able to make SAF, sustainable aviation fuel, is now effectively our primary product, ultimately, for the company. And we're focused on that in a big way. And we're excited about doing things for the aviation community, making aviation fuels. Although today in plant A, we are making about 80% diesel, 10% jet fuel, and 10%, or maybe a little bit less than 10%, renewable naphtha.
And so you really started, I mean, I think it's interesting for people to realize that you took truly a conventional refinery really in the heart of California. And now 10 years later, you're really making renewable diesel, sustainable aviation fuel, and a little bit of naphtha, right? And have those are the products?
Correct. Yeah, and at some point, we'll hopefully be making some propane as well. And I'm sure that's part of your interest and your audience interest as well is the renewable propane.
Well, I mean, I think everybody listening really loves to think about, you know, the future of renewable fuels. And I find it's interesting at the environmental level, you know, there's this mantra that liquid fuels, no matter whether they are sustainable, environmentally friendly or not, that liquid fuels aren't the future. But clearly World Energy believes that not only is there a future for liquid renewable fuels, but that they are really a big part of the environmental portfolio going forward.
Well, absolutely. And as you bring up there, aviation is the one that's really difficult to turn to electric. You know, batteries aren't going to work for long range aviation. And same thing for long range trucking. There's really a role for liquid fuels for long range trucking. You can't have a 40 ton truck with 39 tons of battery. You got to have full capacity to haul load very far. So
it's interesting how few people really seem to understand that you know, a truck that's normally capable of having a payload plus the truck weight itself of 40 tons, 80,000 pounds, if you put 40,000 pounds of batteries in it, you really begin to hamper the purpose of the truck. I find people don't know that. You know, when I talk to people, I usually try to talk through carbon intensity. It seems to be a way that at least you can begin to quantify the carbon of a product. So I know for us, conventional propane, 79 in California, we call it 83. We see the renewable propane that's coming out now, 21. And, you know, we're starting to see some carbon positive. So things that actually are minus, below zero in carbon. Do you find when you're talking about the fuels you make that carbon intensity is a relevant term for your buyer?
Well, it is our only term, frankly. It's my entire focus is trying to reduce our carbon intensity. So the idea of taking a renewable fuel, a renewable feedstock, and converting it to renewable fuel by itself is laudable, but unless you actually measure how much or reduction you have on the carbon versus fossil equivalent, you're really not necessarily accomplishing the intended goal. So we go through a full process of following our feedstock all the way from the beginning of its source until it's delivered, including all the transportation energy that's included, and until it gets to our plant, and then the amount of energy that we use in our plant to make that conversion process. And our conversion process uses hydrogen, which is a very energy intensive feedstock for the process, or co-feedstock. It comes in with, right now, we use pipeline gray hydrogen in our process. So we ultimately want to get that to a greener version of hydrogen. Early on, when the process got started 6 years ago, we used liquid hydrogen trucked in and diesel trucks. And that's a very inefficient way for us to be green. So we're working down that continuum towards a greener product. And so our CI scores, we call them CI, carbon intensity, are measured through, in California, the California Air Resources Board has a good metric way of keeping track of these things. And we go through a process with them that certifies our fuel's carbon intensity. And we earn credits effectively from CARB based on our carbon intensity, a very good system. It's called the Low Carbon Fuel Standard, and they set a standard for our fuels on the petroleum side, and that standard gets ever more difficult year by year. It ratchets its way down, and people who make fossil fuels that are above that line have to find some credit somewhere to balance out that fossil fuel they put into the marketplace, and they look to us to buy those credits since we make fuel that's on the lower side of that a benchmark line that's drifting downward. So yeah, absolutely. Carbon intensity is the metric we use for everything.
It seems to be one of the right ways to talk about it in that narrow lens of greenhouse gases and impact on the climate. Gary, you know, just kind of want to walk back. You're talking about even your own migration from liquid hydrogen that was trucked in now to gray hydrogen, and a migration you would think over time to turquoise or blue or green hydrogen as we walk through that color spectrum. I know you're a chemical engineer with a lot of great experience. Where do you see the future of hydrogen? Is there a future for affordable green hydrogen, you think?
Absolutely. I think that is the future. I think that will be it's a fuel carrier, frankly, or energy carrier and storage for renewable energy that's generated. So we actually have a project down the road. I can't tell you what year down the road it's going to be, but very soon we'll be doing a green hydrogen project of our own on the East Coast of the country here, using essentially electrolytic process, electrolysis, to make green hydrogen.
And then you will in turn take that green hydrogen to probably make a renewable liquid fuel, right? Something like SAF or renewable diesel or renewable.
That's the ultimate goal. Yeah. Absolutely right. Bring that in with some CO2, either from the atmosphere or from a point source, put the two together and effectively reverse the combustion process to make fuel.
And today your feedstocks are fats, oils, and greases, right? Today in Paramount?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
And do you, as you kind of think to the future, do you worry much about the availability or the cost of your feedstocks?
Now, certainly the cost is been climbing over time. And yeah, we are a little concerned about that. But as Gene, our CEO, says, you know, the solution to high prices is high prices. What happen is it'll trigger more innovation for feedstocks, and we'll find some feedstocks in locations nobody had looked at before. We'll bring things out of places, maybe some brown grease. It will come out of the woodwork. And cover crops is, you know, a likely scenario for us as well down the road from a lipid perspective. And actually had a conversation today with one of the national laboratories we're working with. There are some things in the future that perhaps convert cellulosic waste materials, ag wastes, things like corn stover, directly into lipids. Rather, the current process takes those materials through an alcohol process and ultimately alcohol to jet. But there may be a way to shortcut that process and go straight to lipids into our process. Ours is called Ecofining. It's a licensed process from Honeywell, and we work with the Honeywell partners, technology partners, to improve that process. And we're doing things in plant B that have never been done before in terms of changing the yields of our product mix, shifting more towards aviation fuel and less towards the diesel.
Yeah, amazing. I think, again, I'm shocked myself how fast the science is changing as we think about, you know, the ways to find new feedstocks and new processes to turn them into lower carbon renewable fuels. I know we're working with one of your competitors on the camelina weed. I never even heard of camelina weed. And now, you know, I look at the carbon intensity of that product, again, refined using a little bit of hydrogen and captured CO2, but probably is going to go to the market at carbon zero or maybe even carbon positive, which is amazing if you think about these fuels we were making that were carbon intensity of 20 or so at the plant. What's happening is amazing.
So we're currently, our best feedstock is down around 15 and change. So that's the neighborhood we're at today with gray hydrogen. We green up that hydrogen, we'll drop us down to the single digits, you know, maybe 5 or 6 for that particular feedstock. And then there are ways, as you know, to go the other direction. We can make green hydrogen using renewable natural gas with big negative scores on a CI.
And it's not lost on me. You're doing that in California, so there's no real transportation penalty to get it to the market. So it's those are truly low numbers. And it really does underscore what I know you've been saying for a while and what we've been kind of saying behind you is that if the metric is better climate, protecting the climate, these renewable liquid fuels are are the answer, and they're their answer today. I mean, you're doing that today. These fuels are coming out today. And I find so often the narrative is around things that might work 20, 30 years from now, yet you're producing, as you said, single digit carbon intensities today.
Correct. Yeah, that's the neat part about the biofuels. This is, it's now a number of people think that maybe this is an interim fuel for us, but it really has a value. The time value is, when you think about what we're doing to the environment, is we're building this essentially inventory of CO2. It keeps ever growing in the environment, and it's going to be there for a long time. So as soon as we stop growing, you know, that inventory, that the better off we are. So we have less to deal with in the future. So the sooner, there's essentially a time value of money here. It's like an interest rate magnification, a compounding interest rate. So the CO2 effectively causes compounding. So the more we can keep out of that inventory, the better we off we are. So there's a major role for that. CO2 today has a higher value than CO2 10 years from now, reduction, or 20 years from now, if we can do it today. And biological fuels, or the way to do it today.
Gary, I'm guessing as you were moving to plant, I think you call it plant B or plant two, which did you call it?
B, plant B.
Plant B. Yeah, as you were moving to plant B, you've already said California, the permitting process can be quite thorough. I'm sure you did not only a full economic analysis, but a full environmental analysis as you were thinking about building, financing, permitting plant B. Anything come out of either the economic analysis or the environmental analysis that you were even surprised by?
Well, I think on the economic side, the value of our project did get to be larger than I think we originally thought it might be, but that didn't always, it started out as maybe a $500 million project, but it ultimately mushroomed to a $2 billion project for Plant B. And maybe partly that's inflation that we're seeing today, and partly maybe growth in scope. But it has a big impact, that $2 billion, because of the multiplier effects around macro economic investments. It goes well beyond our little site. It goes to essentially the whole economy of the Los Angeles County, the region, California, and then well outside of the region into other parts of the United States. For example, our reactors that will be used in our facility are going to be constructed elsewhere and transported to be put on our site. So not all of the work is done on the site. It is essentially becomes a national project in scope, and it benefits a big part of the country. And yeah, the factor is about 10. So it's a $2 billion project locally becomes effectively about a $20 billion impact on the economy.
Gary, we're going to take a break, and then we'll be right back.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people, with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back, and we're talking with Gary Grimes, Director of Sustainability and Technology for World Energy and a leader in producing renewable fuels. You know, I know you were out in Long Beach at the Advanced Clean Transportation Expo, and then I think later you went to the Energy and Sustainability Forum. So you've been out really kind of seeing kind of where modern technology is, maybe where technology is going. Anything you see out there in the world in the last 4 or 5 months that have you really excited about clean transportation or new technology?
That was it at that particular conference. There was a lot more hydrogen vehicles than I think we've seen previously. So hydrogen is going to be like a bigger player for this long distance trucking. And like I said, we are maneuvering ourselves into that fuel space. So we will have a hydrogen station at our facility, at our refinery. So we'll have not only renewable diesel and renewable aviation fuel there, but we'll also have hydrogen pumps there, effectively, that fuel hydrogen trucks at our site. And there was actually a opportunity about 2 months ago. They had at the California Motor Speedway, where had some of these trucks were brought out, and we could ride them around and drive them on the track. And I had an opportunity to do that and drive some of those trucks, and they do drive really nicely.
Yeah, so interesting.
I think so we'll see a lot more of that.
Yeah, let's move the conversation to a little bit. Again, we know we make renewable propane from the same process. We just finished a study with National Renewable Energies Laboratory that really talked about the economic benefits of making renewable propane as well, particularly when you're making renewable diesel or SAF. What do you see when you think about renewable propane?
So we've long considered the renewable propane where it should go. It has a number of options for us, and it's still going to be the sort of the optional fuel because in addition to road use, it can be used inside our facility, and that's where it goes today. And it's actually used in the production of these other fuels. It's the fuel that we use in our heaters in our process. We don't currently in Plant A have the ability to separate it out, although that's something our engineering team is working on. And by the end of this year, we hope to be able to pull some of that renewable propane out, and put it in the marketplace.
Yeah, the study, and I want to make sure we share it with you because the study was really interesting in that it kind of looked at it from today's economics, and it really showed that there is a tremendous economic incentive to you to sell it rather than consume it. So I know we're seeing a lot more demand for renewable propane as a transportation fuel. And a lot of fleets that thought about going to EV are now backing up and going to renewable propane. So it's an exciting time for, I think, all of us.
Yeah, so it could be here in larger quantities shortly for us. And that is actually, NREL did a study for us a couple years ago. We were part of the study that was, maybe it's 3 years or 4 years back now. It's travel. The time has gone by pretty quickly. But Bob Baldwin there had worked on that study with us.
Yeah, Bob Baldwin, certainly. And he was the author of this as well. So, Gary, one of the fun things we do on the show is kind of use a little bit of magic, give you a chance to have some license. You use the magic wand I'll hand you to make one wish for one thing to change in the next year. So all kinds of ones in there. One wish, one wand, 1 year. You're a man with a lot of a broad field of view, you know, a lot of experience. How would you use your magic wand? And what would you wish for from the lens of climate change?
So I don't know if you look back at my resume, but I got my start in the nuclear industry when I got out of college, working at the Hanford Project on nuclear waste. And so what I would do with that magic wand is I would make a nuclear fusion a reality. I would think that would have the biggest impact on the world globally if we could make nuclear fusion. I know that's a really huge ask. So maybe slightly less than that to ask, I would go for just having acceptability of nuclear fission reactors, the small modular reactors that have been recently, you know, they're trying to bring them to market. There have been designs out there for decades that are safer and smaller. Obviously, the military uses nuclear reactors in a number of vessels worldwide. So we know the technology is out there. It's been functional and workable for years. I would just like to see better acceptability of that because I think that opens up opportunity for a lot. I mean, if you're really concerned, if the world is concerned about greenhouse gases and global warming, I think that is the major answer to that solution just because the massive amount of energy that's available to us is still just untouched. And that's where I would go with that magic wish.
I'm not asking you to be an expert in nuclear power, but it is very interesting to me that even today, France, who's really making a pretty strong step using nuclear power, they don't seem to be embracing, you know, modular reactors. They're really more conventional. You believe in the modular small-scale reactors?
I do.
Clearly, if the world wants to have energy, reliable energy that's low carbon, it would seem to be perhaps one of, if not the best answer there is out there, right?
I think so. And I think obviously still there is need for fuels, liquid fuels, just because of effectively the batteries just can't work for every application, as we discussed. So I think you got to green up the grid with some nuclear, and then maybe, again, reverse fuels if you have to. If you're out of biological feedstocks, you pull the CO2 out of the atmosphere or wherever you can find it and make those powered liquid fuels.
You know, we did a podcast called Is This Diesel's Last Decade? You know, as we kind of begin to think about the future of diesel and really the complexity of diesel in the world that needs to have better and better emissions regulations. What do you think about the future of diesel or the future of conventional jet?
Well, frankly, I think, you know, there are emissions from diesels in general that people had concern about, you know, for decades. Your idea of most people's idea of what a diesel truck looks like, a black exhaust, is terrible from the soot perspective. But today is new technology diesel engines, and the science behind what's going on there now, with the development that the industry has made on those engines is incredible. The fuel mileage they get out of them and the particulate reductions are just massive. So I think the new technology diesel engines are certainly an option, and definitely should be in the future as well. I don't see why they should be eliminated, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've developed a lot.
Do you think they should all operate on renewable diesel?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So in other words, yeah, that's where you're going is these modern engines with modern fuels, specifically low carbon fuels like renewable diesel, that certainly is a part of the solution.
Correct.
Yeah. And we've really had a lot of guests on recently that really that is their mantra, is that the evolution of the internal combustion engine to where it has evolved today in terms of efficiency. If you really, again, going back to carbon intensity, if you really look at those efficient engines with a modern fuel, the carbon intensity can be significantly lower than that of an electric engine when you think about its full economic analysis.
Yeah, and ultimately, longer term, you know, maybe the hydrogen comes big more into play here, but the ZEVs of today that are considered, you know, I had a hydrogen car for years. I drove a Toyota hydrogen vehicle in California. We had actually 40, 45 stations, and I had three of them near my home, and I drove it regularly to work. And my drive is about an hour each way, and it was a great vehicle. I loved that car. But my lease ran out, and during COVID, there was just no replacement that I could find for it.
Yeah, that's great, great comments. So the other fun thing we do here is we love to thank our guests by planting a tree in your name for your time today, and we plant them in a national forest. Now, I did study your resume, and I know you went to Montana State. It could not be a more beautiful place on this planet. I know you spent a lot of time in California. You certainly got beautiful national forest all around. Is there a favorite place for you that you would love to see us plant a tree in your honor?
Well, thank you. That's really gracious of you to do that. I think I put that tree in Montana, in the Helena National Forest, because my family's got a cabin in the woods out there, and it truly is a cabin. And that particular area has been hit by a pine beetle. That's mm-hmm. spruce pine beetle, and it's destroyed a lot of the forest there, which is too bad. You know, a lot of people think that so this gets to the inset versus offset discussions, that you can plant a tree and that ultimately is the same as replacing the fuel with a renewable fuel. And well, frankly, the time horizon is slightly different. You plant a tree and you're looking at a 20 or 30 year lifetime, or maybe 100 year lifetime to really absorb enough CO2. Whereas you burn a renewable fuel, that's today, have an impact today. So yeah, I think that's where I'd like to see that tree, is the Helena National Forest.
Well, that is a beautiful place, and I'll try to finagle it so I can go plant that myself, because then I would be able to see that lovely country again. You know, you keep coming back to it, and I think, how do we tell the story better about the value of decarbonizing now? How do you think we help people understand, as you correctly said, the present value of our actions are much better when they're now rather than deferring for something mythical or magical or maybe not even affordable 20 years from now?
Well, I think this gets back to computer projections of what the climate impacts are of today's savings versus future savings. And you know, frankly, I've been in computers all my life. You always wonder about the accuracy of computers, but I think there's one thing, you know, they're hard to be perfect forecasting tools, but they're very informative. They can be used for information. And so if you tweak that time horizon in terms of that CO2 reduction today versus 5 years or 10 years now, that you will actually see the resulting differences between that. So I think that can display it. You can see two curves, one stacked, one on top of the other. In terms of CO2 and the climate impact of those two differences. And you'll see there is a definite substantial difference between that. And so the sooner we get started, the better. But at a reasonable cost, I think that's the challenge too. So there are certain things we can afford and certain things we can't. So we ultimately have to be able to afford to travel green.
Yes. All right, well, Gary, you've told us about Plan A and Plan B. You've told us about kind of that growth and scale. Talked a little bit about kind of migrating to think about the process and perhaps using better and better hydrogen. What else is coming down the path for World Energy?
So I think, like I said, the most exciting for us is the power to liquids. I think that's... most people think it's probably 10 or 15 years out. We're going to try to make it real. So our company motto is to make net zero real, make it happen today as quickly as we can. So we're always trying to make things move faster. And like I said, we're a small company, but we try to have a big impact. And we want things to move at a much faster rate than they do today. And so that's our challenge, is to move things along quickly. So that's what I'm really thrilled about, is to see maybe plants B, C, D, and E, you know, down the road, and see how fastly we can put these things together with new technology. And so I know there's new technology coming out there to bring new feedstocks into the marketplace, but we're looking at other feedstocks like alcohol as a possible feedstock, or again, power to liquids as you know, no feedstock effectively, the CO2 out of the atmosphere or CO2 where we can find it. So that's what I'm excited about, is seeing what we can make happen and make it real.
Yeah, awesome. Exciting. Well, we're going to look forward to following you. You've been really good in you know, helping our industry as we think about lowering our carbon and still providing those powerful liquid-rich fuels like propane or diesel fuel. So love that. You've been a great guest. Thanks again for joining us today, and thanks for, you know, what you've done with World Energy. Thanks for joining us on Path to Zero.
Well, Tucker, thank you. It's a pleasure being here. I look forward to seeing you again in person someday again.
That wraps up this episode of Path to Zero. A quick reminder, if you want to send me a note to comment on an episode or give me a new topic to consider, just shoot me an email. The email address is path2zero@propane.com. That's the word path, T-O, the word zero at propane.com. You can always connect with me on LinkedIn as well. I look forward to hearing from you. See you next time on Path to Zero.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.